794 Surrey, June 7, 2008. Lecture 1.2, Functions, Types of Software. Actually, continued. Part of this is in the previous recording. Okay, so information management. Lots of... That goes on and on and on. So I would ever suggest, look, I think all of those should be sort of familiar to you, to just look through that and see whether there is a DB management, digital library management system may not be. I mean, so this would be sort of equivalent to a database management system, a system that from which you could configure digital library software for a particular application. So it would have a lot of modules in it, and if your digital library has audio files in it that you want to be able to search, then you would tell it to include the audio search module in it, and if not, then you wouldn't. Specify how the indexes be done, etc.
Do you have a specific example of that?
There may be only one in existence. Okay. It's called the Delos. Delos was an organization of sort of a collaboration of many digital library research units in groups in Europe, and they came up with sort of an infrastructure that would allow that for different modules working together and allow different modules. Okay, there's web-related software. So let's make this a little more interactive. If you have any experience with one of the things that are written there, you want to share with the group. Or again, if one of these functions is not clear to you what it is, then just ask a question.
It's middleware. I haven't heard that term before. Basically like portals?
Well, actually, it's usually generally used in the web environment. It's access to databases through the web. The best known is probably ColdFusion. And what it does, you have a ColdFusion-enabled web page, and there you can embed within ColdFusion tags, then in the simplest case, SQL commands. And somewhere you tell it where is the database source, the data that's right. And then if the user opens that web page, and there needs to be a ColdFusion server associated with it also. Page will be transmitted to the ColdFusion server that interprets the SQL commands, goes to the database, gets the data, and the results of the search, the database search, will be incorporated in the web page that actually displays them. Okay, so you have an XML page that goes to the ColdFusion server. The ColdFusion server gets the data, composes a web page with the results of the query, and displays it to the user. That's one thing it can do. Now, at a more interactive level, the user can put in query criteria, and then the web page, ColdFusion web page with the user's input, is sent to the ColdFusion server. And so it's now not the standard SQL, not same for everybody, but now I want only the people in state Virginia. And then we'll run that query and we'll bring back the result. So at that point, you have a system where you can have a query form that user can put in and get back as a result the results from the database.
Okay. It's not so much, I guess my question is, since I didn't develop that part, would that be likely what was used for an online, our school uses all the access databases when people access those from online, parents look up.
Access has its own web enabled access, yes.
Okay. But it's kind of that type of thing.
Yes, it's that type of thing. But so if the database management system doesn't have its own, or if its own gets more complex or whatever, then CodeFusion is one of the standards. PHP is another. PHP is sort of the poor man's version that is open source. CodeFusion is, you pay and it's more powerful. So there are many sort of, this open source is a combination of PHP and MySQL, MySQL being a database management system. And for the people who have money, you want a more robust version, use CodeFusion and Oracle. Or they will use the Oracle capability to interact with web pages directly. So that is middleware. Information is legal. There's a lot of stuff there. So one thing you might be in this is bibliography analysis. I mean, that's, in my opinion, another case where the one that's most used is by no means the best. If you have a little sophistication, I use a program called... wait a minute, what is... My memory of the name is fading, but it will come to me in a... I'll give the name a little later, but anyway, it's a system that has much more flexibility in terms of it's called Library Master. I thought about that and I thought it wasn't Library Master. In terms of defining your own fields. I mean, you can define a complete set of your own fields if you want to. But with EndNote, you can't. You are stuck with what they have, and they need to have four customizable fields. You can't even define what they are. So you don't have to. They have predefined templates, if you will, that you can use out of the box. But if you want to, you can do your own. And it's... But it has things like you can define your own sort sequence of characters if you want to. If you don't want to, you don't. There's a lot of functionality that other programs do not have. It makes it a little more complex. And that, I mean, it's simple to use out of the box. I think they haven't quite really managed to make it out of the box as simple to use as EndNotes. That's what these programs really need to do. They need to be able to be used as simple as a version for dummies. But if you really want the power, you can then use it. Okay, in sound management, there's the sophisticated voicemail pieces where you sort of can retrieve voicemail. Sort of, it's electronically supported voicemail systems. They're around. Did I put music retrieval in here? No, I didn't. I mean, that would be another piece. They have these systems where they can actually hum some notes and find music pieces where that note sequence appears. GIS falls in there. Support for qualitative research falls in there, because that's essentially, I mean, what you want to do. You have done extensive interviews with 20 people, and you want to, on whatever subject, actually you will do qualitative research, or look at usability evaluation, you observe somebody using software, and you make a standard protocol of that. And to analyze that is essentially a data management problem, because you want to go through there and code specific pieces of your protocol, and then eventually figure, now this is the third time I saw this problem mentioned. So I'm going to make a code for that. And I'm going to, for the other 17 interviews I have, or protocols I have to code, I will watch out for them. And so in the end, then you can make a listing by type of problem and get what the user said. You know, saying that there's a method called Think Aloud, where people talk as they do things and say, where is this function? So, or maybe it's hard to do. And so you find all the places where a certain function is mentioned by user and what they said. And then you can list those on half a page, and that will give you some insights. And so that's qualitative research. It's essentially information management on the results of qualitative research. Genealogy. A big market for software, by the way. It's an information management problem with some specific requirements. You all know Perl's Information Manager, or PIM for short. Or programs that integrate, but at the minimum, calendaring and contact management.
Okay. So kind of
what Outlook does.
Outlook and Blackberries and Palms and all
that. Yeah. And if you get a little more sophisticated, that will include email, and you can do, I mean, you can look somebody up and click on it and send an email to them, or that would include retrieval of email in there for you. And if they're really more sophisticated, then they include what's now called these desktop managers, like the integrated desktop, where you can search email and files and documents. I mean, email and files, what else do you want to search? Appointments, contacts. You can search all of this together. Actually, I think I'm going to talk about my dream team to later, like next week. I mean, not next week. Next time we meet. Okay. Number processing and mathematics, that's fairly obvious. Mathematical manipulation is more than just number crunching. I don't know how many of you know calculus. I mean, you have to get the derivative of a function for some purposes. How fast does something grow at a certain point? And so, mathematics program, there's one particular called Mathematica that does allow symbolic math or solving a system of three equations with three unknowns. You may remember that vaguely from. You may have not done three, we have two. But so these kinds of things can be done. Document generation and formatting, there's lots of that. Okay. There's a fairly wide spectrum here, but they all have to do with document generation. And wouldn't it be nice to have one that does all of them? So that the tool you use to write a document you want to print is the same tool you use to compose the web page or a newsletter. But of course it isn't like that. There are some that really have good editing functions, and you can push a button and get an HTML version of a Word document, but it's not the same as using Dreamweaver for designing a web page. And in Dreamweaver you can spell check as well. I don't know if you can spell check in that at all. I could. You can?
You can.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
And music composition and organization is part of that, clearly. Graphics is part of that. Now, Word does graphics, but it's really a pain. But if you really want to do a graphics with text and all of that, it's very... all right. Anyway, this is document formatting. A data conversion. There are lots of different things. Now, Melissa knows about conversion to Braille.
Oh, yes. I also know about OCR, too.
Uh-huh. Because if you want to go from print to Braille...
That's correct.
You have to do OCR first, and then... Now, 30 years ago, there was a Kurzweil machine. There was no...
Yes,
I think that...
Mm-hmm.
Or OCR plus voice will read. So, there's a lot of different format conversions. The first one, actually, sort of I skipped over. It's a huge problem. As you know... I mean, graphics, there are 100 different graphics programs. There's special software that goes from one to the other because the graphic software you use may only do 15. And you get one in number 57. Okay, what do? You may have to... or the problem of converting just from word processor to word, or between word processors, is by no means solved. It's pain. I refuse to use Word. So I use Word perfect, even now when it crashes, because it's just so much more, it gives a lot more control. In a lot of software, but I think Microsoft software particularly, they are built on the principle the programmer knows best. Never mind what you want to do, that's not the programmer knows best. And so I use WordPerfect, but then if I do a bulleted list, it comes out with dollar signs in Word, and tables, and generally outlines. Some things come through fine, but others do not. And that's so... if I had a... There may be... There may be a third-party program that does the conversion with fully preserving the format. But I haven't seen that yet.
Feature failure comments. When you do something and you don't understand, you go to somebody else and say, is this a feature or failure of the program?
Yes.
Is it supposed to do that or is it messed up?
Right. Okay, anything else in here that's... Now, why would you need sign language output?
If you can't read, I mean, I guess you'd have to learn.
A deaf person. I mean, if they're also blind, then the sign language wouldn't help.
Right.
And so for print, they could read it.
But when you have, like, to automatically interpret what somebody's
saying, for speech,
you've got a speech going on, instead of, if you want to project it.
Yeah, so if you had automatic speech recognition, which is a parallel to OCR, mm-hmm. and sign language output, mm-hmm. you could have a reasonably big screen, one is electrical, and instead of having to have an interpreter there, you could just have the screen and you could see the... And I think I had a deaf student once in class, and they were interpreters, and they sort of after 45 minutes they were exhausted, so they took turns.
Yeah, they have to switch because they would be more effective if you had it available in an English language written version with an alphabet. Would it be more effective to just display the alphabet, to display the words? Or
no,
because
that takes a long time to interpret it too. And sign language is actually faster than reading English.
Reading it? Well, let's put it this way. If they want to do a lecture, if they're in a lecture and they want to read that, It takes time out of, you're not concentrating on what the lecturer is saying if you're reading stuff up on the screen. As well as everything else.
Yeah. Like if you're in a science class,
what
I'm
saying up on the screen is exactly what the lecturer is saying, but I guess that would have to be done in advance.
Yeah. I don't teach from a script, but...
No, but you're saying if you had voice recognition.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You could output it. You could do it like subtitles.
Yeah,
that
one.
But I don't know which is faster because I don't know where it can
send them. That's a good question. So this would be a question of display design.
I wonder if they could read the words faster or do it read
maybe they're gone.
That's what I was asking.
You could close that door, have this one open.
People who sign,
can you press the button so it can be open?
More interactive for them. I'm really good at sign language than reading English. For me, of course, it has
good
to be English.
Thanks.
That's because
it's foreign
to them, it's natural.
Yes.
Because they grew up with it. So I don't know if it's faster for them to do the sign language than it is to read the actual written word.
Yeah, that's an interesting... So I don't know. But that would be something you would need to know
Because I can tell you from growing up with Braille, I prefer Braille over speech output from a screen reader. Because to me it's slow and it's bothersome and it gets annoying after a while. Just kind of tiresome, so I prefer Braille, and that's that kind of question. It depends on the environment that they grew up in. If they grew up reading print as opposed to sign language, they're going to prefer the print output.
Okay, so I made work plan and project management a separate category here. Even so, it actually is. I mean, I could have put it under. It's information management, but it's enough of its own importance that it's here. So this is all the group collaborative management, project management. Computer-supported collaborative work, which would support all kinds of things. This wikis would fall under there, but you could have software where people have whiteboards. They actually, I mean, if they're rich, they can afford this board like this whiteboard, which is computer supported, so you can write, and somebody across the globe who has the same technology and has connected with the proper software will read it. So it's just like being in the same room, writing on a blackboard. But there clearly needs to be a lot more to computer supported
company. They sort of think of the name of it. They use something like that in MLM where they can bring all people together in a conference and you can see them. It's visual and it's audio at the same time.
Yeah,
so
that
it works like a blackboard sort of too. If somebody wants to ask a question that can't, that doesn't have audio.
Okay, so this is just the telephone conference plus video conference.
Yes, together.
But it wouldn't in that case you could ask a question remote, but you couldn't, and you could maybe type something on a screen that everybody sees, but you couldn't write on a surface and everybody else sees it.
Yeah, I've seen this used on I think it's SmartTutor.com. It used to be in a public library I worked in. It wasn't something that the students could log into get help with whatever homework their assignment they were doing. So you would see like them asking things like calculus questions, which we weren't going to help them with, but where they would ask the question or the geometry, and there would be someone drawing on it, whoever was helping them.
But there's also, computer. They need to be able to have a database of what's transpired. They need to be able to access documents while they talk. There's a lot of things to computer support a collaborative work. If three people together work on a document, then you need a program that supports that the document appears on the three screens and some person types in, it appears on the others. But at the same time they can maybe communicate over voice to say this is good and this is not good and those kinds of speeches. All right, communication software, that's fairly simple. The remote access to your own computer may be the most complex of these. And that software exists, so that from wherever you are in the world, you can act as your own computer. Now, I carry my computer with me, so I don't need this. Because, see, the problem is, to use this, you have to be connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have to leave it connected all the time.
And if I'm on the subway, I'm not connected. Or if I'm someplace else, I'm some places you're connected, some places you're not. So, process control. It's a little esoteric, but it's big. A lot of semi-automated factories. Auto. I mean, I tipped over a computer automated design, a computer assisted design. So if they design a car on the CAD screen and they design a port, there will be a machine that's shaving the metal off to make the right form, and that's computer controlled. If it's well done, it will take the specs from the computer assisted design software and feed it into the tool machine and produce the part exactly as specified. It's one piece of process control. I think another piece of process control was that I remember when they make tiles, they have to heat the rubber to a certain temperature. And so there will be a way to determine the temperature inside the tire, and that will go to a computer, and it will either increase or decrease the heat. So you think there's a lot of process control being done by computer.
They have a 3D printer at the NLM that uses a clay material, and they program it so that whatever you're trying to look at comes out in 3D instead of 2D flat. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
They actually did a model of what the NLM looks like from the outside, because I couldn't figure out what that funny roof was. They had fun. I bet you the guys had fun doing that, the programmers.
A lot of business functions. So enterprise resource planning is more integrated. So the idea is just to look, for example, at prices of raw materials and how much will it cost us to produce units of some gizmo, how much can we sell for it at this price, and so then you can figure out how many to produce. And if the price of the raw materials goes down, and you can reduce the price of your gizmo, your model, your marketing model may show you that you could sell 3 times as many. And then you will change your planning. Supply chain management is sort of related, if you skip a little down. That's the idea of... So if you coordinate the orders you get, and from those you determine how much do you have to do at a certain time, and therefore how much do you have to order elsewhere. And that means you minimize what you have to have in storage. If you have it organized so that you can order just the parts and materials you need to deliver the things that have been ordered in time, and you know you can get the things because you know what the delay is between ordering a part and getting it, but then the whole supply chain from getting the order, getting the part, making the production, and delivering the final product to the customer is all managed with the same program. And again, that minimizes costs for inventory. And inventory costs the company in two ways. It costs storage space, and it costs interest. Because what you have in inventory, you paid for. And you either pay for this borrowed money, in which case you have to pay interest, or if you pay for it with your own money, you could not put your own money, invest it somewhere, to make it. Okay, so this supply chain management is and enterprise resource planning, they are big factors in making manufacturing more efficient. And actually, the delivery of services, too, making it more efficient. So they are a big factor in increasing productivity. In customer relationship management, one example of function of that kind of software would be to identify those emails that come from angry customers by doing a mood analysis of the text. Which is actually not that hard to do. And so you get those out for attention. And that's business support for specific business. And whatever business there is, you name it, cash-cutting business, there's software to support it. That particular kind of business is scheduling that with your operations and equipment and so forth. Okay. So I gave you some examples. And but there's a home with a business. Any question, any of the business operation ones? Okay, education, actually I should have said education and training. Education and training is a big market, particularly in terms of training. Because I mean, machinery gets more and more complex. Even software gets complex, and to be used properly, you have to train people. And so there's a whole industry that makes training software to teach you work. Okay. And actually, I think, so this is the preview, because I have a own separate lecture, so let me, some of these things I may say twice. There is software to supply thinking, I mean, to faster thinking skills and problem solving skills. Okay. And then, of course, there's software to teach you subjects. There are different methods how you would do this. One is learning through using. And by this I mean there may be a game that requires addition or some other computation. I think there's one game where a frog jumps in the lily patch from one leaf to another, and you sort of have to determine the force of the jump according to the distance that you see. So it takes a little computation, but it's computation that's functional in the game. And there could be many other games where computation is functional, and so children have to use the computation, but it's for a purpose. Whereas in drill and practice, it serves no purpose. Just gives you a math problem, it gives you a smile if you do it right, and it gives you a crown if you don't. And I guess, I mean, there's a role for drill and practice, but no, unfortunately, in the present environment of education, which is determined by people who have no idea what education is, starting with our president, the market for drill and practice is probably greater than the market for thinking skills after. Because nobody cares about thinking skills, they care about standard of pass the test, standard of learning. In the architect book is another approach, which is sort of the computer assisted instruction, taking to a little more sophisticated level. I mean, computer assisted instruction is a simple level. They present some material, they ask the student some questions, they solve some problems, and if they do the problems right, they go on. If not, They will have a different presentation for the same material, so they will present the material again. I mean, not exactly the same, but different, maybe you can give them examples, whatever, and then they do a test again, and so on. And those could be done quite intelligently. They could also be done in a quite boring, sort of more trailing practice kind of style. The last one is interesting, supporting subject-specific operations. So, for example, if you have equipment in a school that has automatic measurements, you could have an experiment where you heat with a certain experiment, you could vary the resistor of some heating unit, and you could heat some water, and you could measure the temperature of the water, and so you will get, for a given voltage, you will get a point after 5 seconds of water sits, or after 10. So the software could just, normally what students do, they would take these data and plot them. But there's really not much interest in that. The interesting is to interpret the plot, or to compare 5 plots for 5 different voltages and see how it happens. Software could support that process. The data measurement could be done automatically. The plot could be done automatically. And the student now compares the plot. With 5 volts it was that, and with 10 volts it went twice as fast, or 3 or 4 times, or did it go 4 times as fast? So they could analyze, they could do the higher level intellectual work, because the lower level stuff is done by computer.
The graphing calculators have a lot of things like velocity cameras and stuff like that, so that they can... They relate the upper level math classes with the physics classes.
Okay. So that's support for software specific operations. You could use this in language. You could have a program to teach Greek. It can, for a Greek word that's found in the text, find the base form and what the selected form it is, and show how it's derived.
And software that listens, this includes software that listens to and compares verbal, like when you're learning a language and comparing pronunciation.
Yes. That would also, I think, put forward in this stuff. Okay, so they are the interesting things. And then, of course, you could do it by subject. Music education has a lot of computer applications. Mm-hmm. If you have a reasonably good, you could even teach pitch if you have a good microphone that recognizes pitch accurately. Then it goes, of course, by level, it goes by the student's special needs. Then a whole other area, there's management of instruction, gates and all of that kind of stuff. Then there are gates. The thinking logic games, which also fall under thinking skills. And then there are lots of, and as you know, games are big business. So it's a short line. The space taken up in this list just doesn't necessarily reflect the size of the market. And games is another area where the borderline, where the line between software and web pages completely blurs. They have all this Second Life, and for that has, all of that needs powerful software support.
Some of the games, there's blurring between the interactive textbooks and the games.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Really good ones like Oregon Trail and things like that that are very teaching history.
Yes, there is a... There are people who think that the future of education is in games, the playing of which will help people learn things. And there's certainly a lot of it can be done that way. In a way, it's really students growing up in that environment or how to read otherwise. I mean, getting around how to read otherwise. And so it certainly can be done if it's done intelligently. I remember one, it's sort of, just as I said, it's exploring the boundaries. And I think even maybe 40 years ago, somebody came up with this term, edutainment.
Something that I like, I found it when we were doing 641, we were looking for software, educational software. And I guess it goes to the simulation. It's not really games, but there's the simulated frog dissection.
Yes.
And there's an online service called Frog Death. If anybody has kids, they've got simulated frog dissection, and then they've added a fetal pig and a squid and something else.
Oh, geez.
And I mean, it's almost like a game because they give you all these tools, and you know, it's like you're doing it yourself. And then you can put everything under a microscope and whatnot. So I think that's blurring a lot of categories, but it's very interesting stuff.
Yeah, for the old Apple, there was a program where you would navigate a sub through the body, through the arteries and veins, and so you could, and you would encounter all kinds of cells, bad cells and good cells, and
there's a game component to it, and it's also a simulation.
Yes, I skipped over simulation, which is actually, simulation is important in many. For many different places, educational. I think I this might be in a museum where I saw this was sort of like a game, but you would have two bodies moving. I mean, one moving around the other and you could do the gyrovolt gravity, where the attraction is proportional to the mass and inversely. Of the distance, farther away, it's not just linearly, but in that case you could change that, so you could say the attraction is just inversely proportional to the distance, not the square, and what would the movement look like? Or you could make it degrade faster, so it's proportional to the cube of the distance, and what does it look like? So you could experiment with different universes where the laws of physics are different. Simulation is interesting and encouraging. But with the games, I don't know how people have time to do a second life. I have enough to do with my first. But it's still. They can, from what I understand, people pay $75 for a virtual cup that has, if they reach the only three, and they're guaranteed to be only three. And so I don't understand it, but I guess what matters if you're in business, what matters is that actually you can make money. That way. There's a lot of software, or is it a database or is it software? A dictionary. That line is blurring too, because the dictionary, of course, comes with functions to search it. And to some extent, you could separate them, but in products, they are often merged. And And so there are a lot of applications that have a database component and a software component to process the data. You wonder, I mean, as I said, this was not a complete list, but sort of more an illustrative list, and also to show the spread. There's such an incredible spread of software. When I talked about domains, I mean, there's software to plan your garden. There's software to design your house. If you want to build a house, many builders will have software that will show, I mean, give you the. You have a plan, you change the plan, you change this, you change this color, you plant a tree here, and you can plant 1 or 5 different species, and you see it now and 5 years, and how it will look in 20 years. Because people often have no idea. They plant this tree close to the house, and in 20 years it's a huge tree, and it should never have been planted there. Actually, I think just outside this building, they planted a ginkgo tree in some place where a tree of the size of a ginkgo tree, when it's grown for a while, is just not a thing to have. So there's software that lets you do that. There's just whatever it is, you name it, somebody wrote some software for it. And so in terms of thinking about solving problems for people, it's useful to have just in your mind the general principle. Whatever there is, there's some software for it. And what I tried to do here was just to make this principle a little more concrete. I just tell you that you have some things to work with. Well, let's move on to 1.3a, which we will, I think, finish by 11:45, the next page. So I'm going a little over, maybe. Okay, so types of sources for software information. Any of these sources may come in any of three formats: print, or CD, which is now sort of declining. I think it's not such a great idea. And then there's online web. And the reason why I think it's not Dewey Decimal Classification is to come on the CD, as the CD had more functionality. Was both easier and more useful than the web version. But they went on the bandwagon, CDs are obsolete, now we do everything on the web. Which may be true if we had internet too for everybody and the higher bandwidth. But the bandwidth is just not there to do many of these things well on the web. So CD, there should actually be more. There's still things that are available on CD, but it migrates the web to the disadvantage. So there are general information sources for anything, particularly computer science. The journals and magazines that deal with computer applications generically, and they have software. They have other things too, but bibliographic databases. I mean, if I was to look for bibliographic software, I would also look into an information science or library-oriented database. General web search engines. You can search Google. Software with some subject. The other words for the software or program or There could be on a directory like Yahoo that enters for software. So just your general information sources you learn about in 650, information access, can be used to find software information. In so in some way, the half hour we spend right now is a plug-in to 650, to use the computer software metaphor. They are all specific information sources for software. And I would count under those the information sources for education, that specialize in education and technology. Because a lot of that is software. So PC Magazine is essentially a magazine for the use of software. There are directories of software which are on the web now. Catalogs from distributors, and there are software stores. Then AOL and similar forums that deal with specific types of software. And there are lots of, I mean, every software manufacturer versus it's all have a knowledge base online, and there's a lot of sources on the web. So these are sources that focus on software, no matter the domain. But then there are journals and websites in the subject area. So software for gardening planning will be reviewed in a gardening journal. Software for real estate planning will be reviewed in a real estate journal. There must be some journal on how to run a law practice. Like, do you know one?
There's a Law Administrators Association. I don't know if they have a journal, though. There's a Law Librarians journal.
Well, there may be a Law Library journal.
Yeah, there's definitely one.
And if there is software on how to deal with information for a law practice, I'm sure it may be reviewed in PC Magazine, but maybe not, because those review sources generally are review software that is more generally applicable. And so the more very specialized software may actually be reviewed more likely in domain-specific journals that deal with this domain, and software is just part of what you need to know. So software, how to run a medical practice, is more likely to be reviewed in a medical administration journal. And, of course, medical information has its own journals. So there you have journals that belong both to the information sources on software and computer applications category and the main category, because that's the intersection of the two. All right, so how to evaluate these sources? And again, what's here is generalizable to any kind of evaluation of information sources. Coverage, which can be defined by a variety of ways. Subject area. So some website may specialize in content management software, and that's what they have information reviews on. It could be by type of computer, an operating system. So you may have an information source dedicated to software that runs under Windows. And then you have some that's dedicated to software that runs under Linux, or Unix. Or you have Apple software and PC software and So it's by I just forget the commercial status. When I mean regularly, this may not be, this may have different interpretations. What I mean is just commercially published software. Windows, Excel, CodeFusion, as opposed to either shareware or public domain software. I have to find a different word for that only, because it means, I just get it, isn't that right? What would that mean? It's just, and software information is also specialized by that. Now, one thing we will talk about actually today in the evaluation criteria is cost. But, and I'm going to mention this at least three times so it really gets down to you. The cost of buying the software in many cases is maybe 5% or less. I mean, in some cases maybe 50% of what the total cost of doing this, of using it. But sometimes it's just 5% or 2% of using it. And so say if you talk about content management in a company, the major cost there is installing the software, training people in using it, and the time they spend with it. And so they may save money and buy a $10,000 piece of software, and it takes twice as long to do anything. So they spend $1 million more in salaries every year than if they had bought a better $100,000 piece of software. And that's the same between freeware and public domain or open source. I think open source should be mentioned in this. This piece. So, to restrict one's purview just to open source software because it doesn't cost anything is not a good idea. It may take more work to install the open source software. And it may be the best, but it may be not. So you really have to look at the total cost of buying, installing, and using the software, which includes both training and then the actual work that people spend with it. And so it's not a good idea to just restrict yourself to one of these things. But nevertheless, there are information sources that are limited to one kind by this. The kind of publication might be another one. TimeScope. Some of these databases only have programs published in the last 2 years. And sometimes older software is still good. Then is it comprehensive or selective? That's again a general criteria of any kind of source of bibliographic source or experts or whatever. So if it's comprehensive, how complete is it? Does it actually have everything? If it's selective, how good is the selection? So are they really selecting the top or not? And then current means how up to date is it? Which it could be, have software 20 years back and be current instead. So in terms of if something is published today, it's there. Or if something is announced today, it's there. The status of being announced. Okay. So the coverage is one piece. Then what information is there is another. So, what features are covered for each program? So, in a word, if they give you information about word processing programs, they may not give you much at all. But then all they have for each program of feature list and say which features does it have. What features does it consider? Okay. The details in which the feature is covered, the other evaluations of software in the source. If so, how good are they? Do they compare programs? Or can you make your own comparison? Like, you know, some e-commerce sites, and this is again a general principle of anything, they may have a feature list of electronic cameras, what do you call them? The digital cameras. And they may let you select four cameras, and then they'll give you a side-by-side comparison. So can you do that kind of thing in the source of software you're looking at? And do they give you a sort of a final score? There are two types of scoring. Do they give you scores by feature? And then do they give you a final score? No. Score by feature may be better. Why?
You might want to have one feature over another one when you're looking at different softwares.
In the software evaluation process, you may need to come up with a total figure of merit in the end. But you may weight the features differently from what their weighting formula is. And so what their four stars as compared to their three stars, you may refer their three star broken because the feature you really need is the one that's good. So, and lastly, how is information arranged? Is it arranged in an easily cast form? Would be a piece of evaluation. And how can you structure it? Okay. If this is a database of full text reviews, can you search by free text? But then, if you are interested in compares on a given feature, free text search may not be the best, as you know. It's not the best for our case, the controlled vocabulary. Maybe better here particularly to have a index language of features where each feature is expressed in a unique terminology may be quite useful. Now, of course, if they cover a wide area of programs, an area of these types we talked about before, the index language of features may become quite big. And so you may want to be able to actually then even just navigating the index language becomes an issue. And if you could say, I mean, this is in content management systems, so give me the content management specific criteria that you use and give me the general software criteria that you use and let me look over, and they may be hierarchically arranged, so let me look over your English language from my point of view so you don't have to look over everything. And actually even on the general criteria, some may be more important than others for content management software. Okay, so when you do your own checklists, there are the specific criteria for the specific software, the type of software that you evaluate. From the 20 pages or so that you have in here about general software criteria, again, a subset may be used for the content management software. Another subset may be useful to educational software. Another subset may be used for the gardening software. So when you want to search a software database by feature, it would be helpful to be able to navigate the index language of features by type of software. Then what data elements are searchable? Can you search by schools? Okay. And if you search by schools, can you find everything that's 3 stars or above if they have a 5-star system? And anything else we only 60 about what makes a good bibliographic search system or the better OPAC for a bad one? Applies here. Yeah.
Two other sorts of reviews. I've got my opinion, but I'm wondering whether you
okay. Go ahead.
You consider them legitimate or not? One is, you know, if you hit Amazon and you look at something that's sold by, you get lists of stuff from people who bought it on whether they liked it or not.
Okay.
And it's not a formal review at all, but it is a vote from somebody who presumably has actually gone out and used it. So I don't know whether that counts as a review, whether you're interested in that or whether you're not. So that's one category. I'm less interested in those because they don't tend to do a lot of analysis. But they might help you decide whether to buy it or not. And then the other one is I've found a number of things that are comparisons, rundowns of you know, multiple different kinds of things like your database
yeah.
management stuff
yeah.
that aren't published in a journal, but they may be coming out of Cornell or you know, a university somewhere. So you feel like they're probably not students, or I don't know if they're students or not, but I mean they seem like legitimate places that have done usability studies or at least analysis of features. And again, is that a review? Can you use that sort of information?
That would be fine, yeah. And the Amazon type.
These are good stuff for people who've used it. Are
well, I mean, if I for the in-depth evaluation of one program, I would look at these kind of things like Amazon. Now you have to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how much these people know,
right.
And they may tell you all kinds of horror stories about using the software, which are caused by the ignorance. However, it's useful as a red flag. I mean,
yeah.
you can then look and see, is this really not possible to do this?
Mm-hmm.
So here, and somebody else may have responded, yeah, you can do it this way. Or it may be hard to do. It may be somewhat, as I said, I mean, somebody may complain about that you can Microsoft's world, you can, all the tables you can do are scrums because they are the top and bottom margin for the cells is 0. And I can't change it. No, they haven't figured out how to change it. You could. Now, once you figure out how to change it, at least you can change them, it just doesn't work. But it makes you aware of possible problems. But then you cannot take those at face value. You have to check. Yeah.
If you use Google and then whatever kind of software you're doing, and then you experiment with adding words like review or review EDU so that you only get the university
yeah.
precise, I mean, I found more stuff. This is in 641 when looking for reviews. That was very useful.
Oh, absolutely.
But
yes.
You can't, but if it's from a comm site and they turn out to be selling something, then you can't rely on it.
You cannot rely on it, but it's I mean, there are different sources of information that contribute in different ways. I mean, the most complete feature list of software may come from the software producer.
And
what it does.
Is that a review?
It's not a review. But again, for the detailed analysis, I would look at what I have to say. And some of the features may be hyped. So you have to, ideally, you would at least want to look at the manual. You then have access to to try it out. I mean, to at least see how the manual says it's going to be done. So you can see whether it's easy to do or not. Alright, and then we have finally here evaluating software reviews. There's an old article, but it is still useful. What I cut out here was a long list of information sources for software from 1985. That's not useful anymore. But the intellectual content of how to evaluate software reviews has not changed. In the top page there's sort of a summary of that, but I think it explains itself. So I'm not going to go through that. So let's just see if there are any more questions or comments on the software information sources.
I'll let you know once I've started.
Okay. Okay.
That's good.
Yeah. So this just gives you a general framework how to deal with that. Well, then it is time for an early lunch. But it falls like an early lunch break because that's how it fits in the schedule. So we continue at 12:30, and then we'll spend considerable time with software specification and evaluation criteria. End of this lecture. 794 Sylvie. Lecture 1.3b to 1.4, software specification and evaluation criteria, June 7, 2008. Okay, so we're on page 13, and I'm going to walk through this long list of criteria. There's an overview on page 13, so we'll first there's general information about software you want to know about. Second is capabilities or features. That's the specific to the type of software. And then the remainder of the criteria are generic. Is it bug-free? Is it sort of linked to features? But then what environment does it run in? Cost and ease of use, so they're closely connected. Documentation. How is the user interface? Can multiple people use it? Security, and how it relates to other programs. So general information is just the name, who produces it, which is important. So who stands behind it? Important piece. What general type is it? How long has it been on the market? When was it last updated? The number of sales. How widely is it used? Make a difference for many purposes. How much does it cost? Is there a demo version available? Are there examples or built-in applications included with the software? So in some, like Library Master, I think has two or three bibliographies included. Or some spreadsheet programs may come with spreadsheet with the formulas for mortgage computation or whatever. So then those are things you want to know. Now, in terms of who stands behind it, you will also need to look on third-party people and other consultants that can help with this.
I mean, there are, for some large programs, there is a whole industry of people who make a living on consulting on that software. And for some of open source, I mean, open source that's directed at the business market, the business model is to make money on helping people to install and maintain and use open source software. Because it's complex and you don't have... It used to be if you buy a program from IBM, then IBM would, for free, supply support. Actually, they don't do this anymore even for software you buy. Allgate doesn't give you free support, or only limited. And as you know, if you buy a program for the consumer market, support may be free for a limited amount of time, but after that you pay. So it's unbundled. And in open source software, essentially the software is free, but you have to pay for the service. And so, I mean, you want to know about the producer vendor so you know how long will this program be maintained in general, but also for what kind of support can I get in the open source exploit problem. So I'm not going to talk about B. I am not going to talk about C, except saying it's program correctness. And how many bugs are there? And how often does it crash? And I have a problem in Word Perfect which cannot be generic. It must be something that interacts with something on my machine. But even after I reinstalled all of it, it still happens. If I highlight a text and I use Control X to cut the block, after a while it will crash. So I have to copy the block and then delete it. But I mean, there are known bugs. There will be a list of known bugs. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, if it just does not do something, it's one thing. If it crashes, another. Then it's something to watch out for. It's hard to know unless you have a review that really thoroughly tested it. The computer environment supported. Actually, there are two answers: what's required and what's supported. There may be a minimum of main memory required, but it will support more. In terms of that particular criterion, applies mainly now to operating systems. And actually, I don't even know whether Windows has an upper limit now. I mean, you may not. In the early DOS, it would support 640K of memory. And that was the end of it. It wouldn't support more, even if you had more on your machine. There was some special software that let you tweak that, but I think it was Bill Gates. The same thing from Bill Gates. 640K should be enough for anybody. So I do not know whether XP has limitations. They may, because it's a matter of what they call the address space, and there's, depending on how that's handled in the operating system, that make a limitation. But at least now they do. So I say 640 kilobytes, right? 640K, right? Not meg, kilobytes. Whereas now a gigabyte of memory is normal.
Right, memory on cheap thumb drive.
Yes. Now, the most important piece here is in small print, the computer environment required may be used forward or backward. In the forward mode, it is, we have this computer environment, and so we will limit our consideration of software to software that runs in that environment. That is too limited thinking.
Because hardware these days is cheap. And so if you have a graphics group in your company and they now have PCs, maybe you just better get them Macs, because they have better graphics program for the Mac. I think it's said that the first spreadsheet was called VisiCalc, sold more Apple computers than any other program. So people wanted to run this software. That's what they got the hardware for. So the way, so it's, but it's a bad idea to look at it in the forward mode. You really need to look at it in the backward mode in terms of saying, okay, here's this piece of software that we really want. What is it going to cost us to install it? And you just need to add to the cost a precision or change in hardware. Now, this may make this too expensive, and in the end you may do something else, but at least you need to look at it, because it may not. It may be the best solution, maybe to spend some more money on hardware. Okay. So that's the backward mode. Have selected software, check what hardware I need. Of course, if you're at the beginning, if you haven't bought a computer yet, then clearly you should first look at what kind of applications you want to run, what kind of software you need, and then get the computer. If you already have a computer, then you still should do it backward, just considering the cost. Under D1, there's a bunch of hardware requirements one should look at. And so output devices supported, there it gets, disk requirements, memory, usually all of the things are there. But it will not run on all makes and models. And if you have a legacy machine, main memory may be a problem. If you have a new machine, it probably isn't. And it may be a problem because software has a tendency to use all the capabilities it can get. And so if most people now have computers with 2 gigabytes of memory, and you want to run something on a 3-year-old machine that is only 500 megs of memory, that may run into trouble, and you have to check. In terms of output devices supported, of course, normal printers are usually supported, but a plotter may not be. Or that 3D printer, in quotes, the 3D output device at the National Library of Medicine, once it is that a commercial device, or is it a special made for NLM?
Which one?
The 3D printer.
The 3D is... I'm not really sure. I don't know much about it other than they have it, but it's becoming more popular, so I don't think it's put out by the NLM. Okay,
so if that thing comes on the market, that may not be supported by all software.
Yeah.
And so then... if you want to do this kind of thing, if you want to support this kind of device, then that's something you need to look at. Output format supported. So does the software support output to PDAs? The special requirements on PDAs? Other hardware, does it support a soundboard? If so, which ones? I mean, particularly if you get into some more fancy kind of sound stuff, there may be very fancy sound devices, and some software may support it and some may not.
I had a question. Just looking at the PDA and cell phones, when you think of it, I don't know if it's related to this, but just in general, it seems like there's a lot of things now, actual hardware like the Kindle and the Sony Reader and stuff, where the software is bundled with the hardware, and there's no... Is there a way to... Would we use the same kind of software evaluation model for those kinds of specific software?
I think so, because you still want to know about the capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
But it then would say that it supports this and only this hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't use it elsewhere.
This is an example of the opposite direction. This only uses Windows CE. You can't put anything else in it, and they've got it in here wired, so you can't put anything else in it. If anything has to be done, we've got to send it back to the company.
Mm.
And that will happen. The reason they do that is so that they can provide tech support. if everybody was able to put in their own plugins and so forth into this, tech wouldn't be able to help them.
Right, but I mean the Kindle Reader has its own reading software, and you can certainly evaluate reading software. I mean that's meant for a book reader like this, and there may be other readers, and they may have their own proprietary software. But clearly, the better model and more consumer choice would be if they were to sort of have some standards whereby different pieces of software would be run on the same hardware. But if you don't have it, you can still evaluate the software. Because the reading software is supposed to have certain features in it. Okay, and then of course there's the software, the system software environment, on what operating system does it run. And some software runs on a number of operating systems. There's a version of Word for the Mac. However,
it crashes all the time.
It may not have all the functionality. So if it runs on different operating systems, you really have to be careful. Is it really the same software? Or some similar software with the same name? You know, I use a calendaring system produced by Now Software, and they're really a Mac company. And at one point they did that. Windows version, which is still, I don't think, but it hasn't been updated for 3 or 4 years. The Mac version is going to be first developed, and I think the Mac version has more capabilities than mine does. Does it run on the network? On the network operating system? And does it need Java on there, or the Net2 environment? Those are all sort of, I mean, if you consider the Java interpreter part of the system software, sort of almost like part of the operating system. Actually, could some operating system may bundle Java with it. I'm not sure that they do now, but in any event, what environment do you need to run this? This can get a little more sort of down to more specific pieces, like you may have an accounting system that has been specified in a database management version called Alpha 5 now. And so in order to do this, you have to have Alpha 5. Actually, it turns out you don't have to have the full Alpha 5 system. You need to have what they call a runtime version. That a runtime version doesn't let you define tables, or doesn't let you define SQL queries. It just provides the support, like as an interpreter, to run the accounting application. The person who made the accounting application, they use the full version of Alpha 5, but the same is true for Origin. It's the same version for Origin. They wrote all the table definition, the SQL, and what's needed. But then they have data input screens, and they have a choice of 7 different reports, and if you want something else, you're out of luck. But it requires the runtime version of Alpha 5 for Origin. Just like some programs require JavaScript, I mean Java, to run. And I have some software that says it needs the Net 2.0 environment. So before I can run it, I have to download that and install it. Or on a simpler vein, if you may have an application specified as a complex Excel spreadsheet. And you can actually buy such applications that essentially give you an Excel spreadsheet. Well, for this to work, you have to have Excel. Except that, I think, whatever perfect office spreadsheet is, we'll also read it. Because the real perfect office and the Microsoft Office applications are reasonably compatible.
But next comes cost and ease of use. And so here, say the second time, the acquisition cost is usually just a small part of the total system cost. And I put them together here under one section because ease of use, as I said, is a major determinant of total system cost. And we shall see that ease of use has two pieces. One is how much learning do you need to do to do the program? And then once you learned it, how efficient is it to use? And clearly both of those have a major impact on how costly it is to use this program after you got it. All right, so cost is divided here in installation cost and daily operating cost. Installation, that's is the cost of acquisition, including how much it costs to evaluate it, or everything we talk in this course will also apply to designing new software. You come up with a feature list, sustainable design, and so on. In this case, acquisition would mean producing. So in your case of the access system, the cost is writing the access specification in-house.
And the time it takes to enter everything.
And well, that's the cost of use. Okay. The alternative is you pay $300 for some, or $500 or $1,000 for some small system, library automation software, or you do it in-house. Now, it may be that in-house you don't pay out money because the people would otherwise sit and twiddling their thumbs. So that's something you need to look at. But if it's not a requirement that it exists, comparable to that is the cost for producing the program in-house, or having it written by some. But many people do that. I need to feed the software. None of, well, if the market suits me, I will go to some programming shop and I will pay them to write something to my specifications, and that would be acquisition cost. Okay. Then not at all trivial is the cost of getting the program to run in a given computer environment. I'm sure you have personal experience that some programs you install and they work, and some you install and they don't work, and 3 days and $50 support later maybe it'll work and maybe it still has problems, and it may interact with other things you have on your computer, and there are all kinds of problems why it will not run. So it's not trivial to get it running. Then depending on what type of program it is, there's a cost for building applications. So if you buy a database management system, that by itself doesn't do anything for you. You have to now say, okay, I want to do this, I need these tables, I need these kinds of predefined reports. Somebody has to specify the tables, the predefined reports. There's a cost, and either in-house or external. Okay. And part of the installation cost is training cost, and may actually more than everything else together we talked about, depending of course of how many people there are that need to be trained. I broke it down into three categories. If the program requires defining applications, then you have to train the people to do this. Unless you have it done externally, which is, of course, then that cost doesn't apply. It comes elsewhere. Training costs for data entry personnel and training costs for data use personnel. They may be the same, they may be different. But there is, I think, my non-profit I'm involved with, they bought this fundraising program, and I think each of them was away for at least a day, maybe two, to get trained in how to enter data and how to get out data. And then there's maintenance costs. You change, you upgrade your operating system, the program still works. There come updates, and then there's the question, do you need the updates? But if there are updates, some of them are free, some of them are not, you have to, but it may give you more features, but then there's also, I mean, actually any of these costs go with maintenance. The installation, the training, if there's an upgrade, it may require additional training, maybe not. But so this is all installation costs. So this is what needs to be done before the program is used at all. So upfront costs. Then there's daily operating costs, which is computer time and staff time. Computer time may be the smaller part of that. Okay. How fast does it run influences both. If there's a response time of 10 seconds, it takes 10 seconds of computer time and 10 seconds of staff time. Okay. How many computer resources it needs is a question. Particularly in a multi-program environment where multiple programs run the same machine. So on page 16 they have for programs that manage information. There is the cost for building the database. And this is data entry and then database creation and maintenance and building indexes and all of that. And cost for using its query input and the time for searching. And there's sort of a general rule, everything else being equal. Having the same quality program, the more effort, computer effort in that case, is expended on building indexes, the faster query. Also, often redundant storage will give you faster performance in search. And if search time is important, then it may be worth to spend more on storage space. And of course, all of these things are heavily dependent on the size of the database. If you have a small database, none of this matters. If you have a reservation system for a large airline, it's a huge database. And of course, in that case, speeds of the essence. And immediate update is the essence. So that's another question on database systems. Do you require immediate updates? Or can you just sort of store all the additions somewhere and then add them to the database overnight? It'd be cheaper. Are there any questions on that part of cost? Or asking on the cost in general. So again, it's important to understand this difference between the installation cost and the use cost. And the more this program is used and by the more people it is used, the larger the proportion of the daily operating cost in the total cost. Okay, so that may be 90%. And installation cost may be 10%. And of the installation cost, acquisition may be 10%. So maybe 1% of the total cost. Because all these other. So the program that, if you have two programs to compare and one costs a little more, even 10 times as much. Mm-hmm. But it's so much better that it reduces the other kind of cost, then that may be worthwhile doing. And again, many people make the mistake of just comparing the cost to acquisition. It's just very faulty thinking. Okay, ease of use. So this actually is a very tricky issue. I mean, you will get an ease of use score in some reviews, so that in some reviews just have 3 stars, 4 stars, and 1 total, 2 score. Some give you a little differentiation, like features and ease of use. But just one ease of use score doesn't do. So as I said before, there is a mountain ease of learning. And there's more things in here, but the two most important ones, and I see I have them in the different order, ease of performing operations after having learned, and the ease of learning. And you have to look at both of these. And if somebody uses the program a lot, clearly ease of performing operations is the more important of the two. On the other hand, if you have software that's to run in a walk-up kiosk that people use once, amount of learning, which has to be zero almost in that case, is paramount. Okay. So there's that complication. That there's a difference between the learning and the ease of use, the ease of performing operations once you learn it. But it's much worse than that, because somebody may do 25 different functions of a program, and for each of the functions this applies separately. So I can compare two word processing programs. Well, one of them may make it very easy to define spacing between paragraphs, but tables will hold. The other, defining spacing between paragraphs, may not be so easy, but, and I'm not talking about sort of ease of performing functions, but tables may be very easy. Graphics, it's another point. I mean, from what I understand, I think, I mean, I haven't done any usability test, but by my own estimation, at least for people who want to control what they do, Word Perfect is easier to use than Word overall. But graphics are easier in Word. Particularly since in Word you could also do your graphics in Visio and put the Visio figure in the Word. And then the way that suite is integrated, when you come, for instance, comes to editing that figure in the Word document, you're taking the Visio. You do it, you finish editing, you're back in Word. So it's not sufficient to give one total score. there are, or even separate scores for ease of performing and ease of amount of learning. It's feature by feature by feature. And there may be some overall sort of I mean, you can tell, well, in most features, this one is easier than this one. But when it gets more complex, is it easier for whom? Some people have a good memory for shortcut keys. Others don't. Clearly, once you know shortcut keys, the ease of performing operations is improved, which will help people with the memory for shortcut keys tremendously. But people who don't have a good memory for that, that is a problem. So you may have program A, which is a lot better to use the shortcut keys, but not quite as good with if you use GUI and click and point and click. Where the other one is good for point and click, but doesn't have shortcut keys. So one is good for some people, not good for other people. So the chief take-home message is ease of use is complex. And so let's go a little more into this. In ease of performing operations, one is cognitive load, the memory and thinking required. I think I know people who use computers for years, and to copy a selection, they go to edit and then they click copy. Which just boggles my mind. You can do Control C or paste. But they have to think. I always marvel at people who click on the right arrow key till they get to the end of the line. When they could just press end. But there's a little bit to learn, there's also an end key. And then to think about doing it. I mean, I catch myself sometimes, and I know the perfect shortcut key for save S. And sometimes I still click file and save S, even so it takes longer, because I just don't bring up the cognitive energy at that point to do it. So that's one part. And then there's efficiency. Now there's a C also macros. And which comes later in the thing, can you define macros? But I'll talk about that here. This one further complication is ease of use. And that is ease of use of the program for the people that you signed it for, or that you were installed it for. Given the configuration and customization you did. So if the program allows for definition of macros, then you can define many operations through macros, or you can do, I mean, it says, and most programs allow you to do that, to customize the toolbar. So, in document formatting, to me, I mean, I want things, I don't want to have two lines on one page and then five lines of the same paragraph on the next. So I often require this function, keep the text together, which I can do with point and click, but I made a macro. Do all P and it's done. Users may not be able to do this, but if you have it well organized, the data processing function in the company, you have people who will customize and write macros for end users. And so then the ease of performing operations in that case needs to be judged not against the program that comes out of the box, but as against the program when it is customized. Of course, in the cost, you have to, it's part of the installation cost. You have to count it here. Yes?
And every time you get an upgrade to the program, there's the question of whether all your customizations will work on the new version or not. It just adds to the cost of maintenance.
Yes, yes, it does. But if you have 500 people using your perfect and you train them to form the documents nicely and they need this key together function often, mm-hmm. it's worth it. And I just reinstalled your perfect and before I didn't have time to change the template and so I did some documents, it drove me crazy. Because my customization makes my work easy, wasn't it? So that's another piece to look at. What do you evaluate? And so people may complain, but it's difficult to do X. And you look at it, and yes, out of the box, it's hard, but it takes half an hour to define a macro to do X, and then it's very easy. So that's another part of things to look at. But coming back to either performing operations, the user willing to think or learn something may need fewer key steps. Okay. Then comes amount of ease of learning. So how much we have to learn. What can do means what the program can do. There is there are two kinds of learning. What can be done with the program? And in some way, that's more important. That a user will learn about the capabilities. Because otherwise, I think, I know I did this sometimes, it was awful, to format the pages for double-sided printing, so you would have a little bigger margin inside. And I did it page by page. And I didn't know that there is a function in the print that you can, or the form in the page that you can just define and insert, they call it binding width. Okay, so the first thing is to learn what the program can do in relation to the functions I often need to do, or sometimes need to do. And then when I actually need to do it, I can still learn then how, or look it up. And I may do it only once, in which case I don't need to learn it, but at least I need to know what. Then the question, how intuitive is it? If it's intuitive, then you don't need to learn much. If it's not intuitive, then you need to learn. Is it consistent within the program? That's a matter of intuitiveness. If it's very consistent in the program, it's more intuitive. How similar with other programs? Now, some of that may be customization. I think WordPerfect has a way to run it like Word, and Word has a way to run it like WordPerfect within limits. Okay. Is there good documentation, online help? If there's good online help, you need to learn less. No. Generally, online help doesn't help you if you don't even think about that the program could do this. Okay, that's where the learning what comes in. Or computer savvy. I mean, if one is savvy about word processing programs in general, one would assume that there is a binding width function. And one wouldn't need to learn this for a new word browser that one is forced to use. And if it's very easy help and very easy instructions on how to set it up in sort of a wizard type environment, then I don't need to learn as much. A good documentation. Then there's ease of learning. And can you learn as you go? Such as a program that is place shortcuts with the menu options. A user can almost not help. Well, maybe some users could help, but the half an intelligent user could not help learning the shortcut key for something they do time and time again. Okay. Ease of remembering. how easily can I remember? Think there was at one point there was a program called Wurstall, which was sort of the king of the word processing market. And their operation was basically based on shortcut keys. And the people who really used it often, they were very proficient at it. But for some reason, use it often. There was no mnemonics. The shortcut keys were just sort of randomly assigned to levels. It was very hard to remember and very hard to do. On the other hand, even the ease of remembering, you could counteract by having a one-page cheat sheet, which for some programs you can buy. It's part of the documentation. And then that makes it easier. Or, I don't have that anymore, but I mean, WordPerfect 5.1, which probably was the best word processing program given the limitations of the general computer environment at the time, of all time. I mean, in relation to what could be done there, it was much better than what's there now in relation to what you can do in the computer environment. Very logical defaults, and they had a little template you put around the function keys, or on top of the function keys. And so you didn't need to remember it vaguely, but you could just look, and here says whatever, page formatting, control F8, could remember it. It's almost like a menu, but the limitation is a shortcut key. Okay. How customizable is it? I talked about that. That has a lot to do with ease of use. It's many of the pieces here. Is it available in the user's native language? What in the software world is called localization? And that makes a big difference for menus. I mean, if you use it in Paris and you have to use English, again, for some users it makes no difference, but for others it makes a big difference. All right, so here's ease of use sort of by general function, not by specific feature. As I mentioned, you really have to do it for every feature. But you could look at ease of system definition by non-system people. So in a database management system, system definition would include ad hoc queries. How easy is it for an end user to write SQL queries? Or is there some other way to define queries that's easy for an end user to use? And then how easy can it be done by system people? There are two, and the ease of use, actually I should say, this is meant for daily operation use. So ease of defining the system. So ease of defining a database application with DBMS, that would be under installation and maintenance costs. Okay. So, if you need to report, how hard is it for an end user to define their own report for auditing? But then, it may be somewhat less difficult to take an existing report and tweak it. So, you want to know how easy is that. How good are default settings? That can make it big difference. Okay. Very big difference. Again, do a simple example for search. Should the search be case sensitive or not? The default should probably be it's not. Because it's easier to correct. It's easier to see the errors come up and correct. If you have default case sensitive is served and the user doesn't know it. Certain things will not be found, they will never know. Now, RoPerfect 5.1 had a very intelligent default for that. If you entered the search character in lowercase, it would search case insensitive. If you would enter in uppercase, it would find only uppercase. And case sensitive search most of the time means find is uppercase. It's very rare that you want to find it only lowercase. So they had investigated the problem, and they had a good default. And it was much easier to do case-sensitive search than it is in any work puzzle now. We have to specify it, and where you couldn't say, I mean, find this upper or lowercase. I'm just thinking. So actually, in root over perfect now, you can either say the search is case sensitive or it isn't. So if you want the first character to be either uppercase or lowercase, and the other characters you don't care, then wait a minute. The first character you want only uppercase, and for the other characters you don't care, you can you do it? No, you cannot. Because you search case sensitive, and your search argument is an uppercase character and then a lowercase character. If that character thing appeared somewhere in the middle of the capital, you wouldn't find it. Okay, so the RoPerfect 5.1 solution, in addition to being easier on the user, also gives you more power in specifying what you want to do. It's little pieces, but defaults, there are many default settings you can look at that make a difference. Okay. And on page 17, you need to change E and F, the last real line there, the characters under E and F, you change them to F and G. Didn't catch that. Change the outline. And with all of this cost and ease of use, there's performance measurements. So you want to know how fast does it do X. I mean, even in Word, printing a large document is a problem. Because it will take up to a minute to format the document for printing. In this one. Alright, so any questions on the ease of use? And again, the short story here is ease of use is a difficult concept. And the complexity is rarely recognized.
You know, this applies to the software at best. But most companies don't use every single function that software has to offer. So,
well, again, ease of use, if the truth be known, needs to be specified function by function, feature by feature. If a company or organization never uses a feature, never expects to use it, the ease of use for that feature, they couldn't care less about that feature. Whereas things they use often, they need to care a lot. But when it turns out they have to use it after all, then they're stuck. All right. Documentation. Yeah, I think we are being good on time. Page 18. Now, you all know to saying, if all else fails, consult the manual. So, ideally, users could just use the software for the first time and use it well. Now, that, of course, is a fantasy. I mean, people say that, and for some things it may be okay, but for things of any kind of complexity, it's not feasible, and will lead to such sub-optimizations as I did, formatting each page to move the left page a little bit to the left and the right page a little bit to the right for the binding width. At the very least, you need to know what the software can do as far as you need to know to produce the kind of function that you need to do. If it's documents, it depends on your document. If it's spreadsheets and you need to do certain things, it depends. You need to be able to do those things. If you never need to compute a sign of some number in a spreadsheet formula or other complex function, you need to look there. But if you sometimes do that, at least you need to know that the spreadsheet has a lot of mathematical functions. That much you have to learn. And then when you come to it, you can then go and look at the list. It's fine. And if the list is well organized and grouped in some way so you can find what you need quickly, it's even better. But so you still need a documentation. A demo is nice. And let me just say, I mean, if it was really true that people could just sit down and use words, or use some web page editor, or use Excel, there would not be an industry that offers courses to do that, and that industry would not survive. But in fact, there are a lot of companies that offer that kind of training, and many organizations send their people to training. Okay, so, makes sense. And when I get a new program, I do like to have at least a look at the manual. I think when I got this tape recorder, or not tape recorder, digital recorder, I did minimal investigation, just enough to be able to know how to do a new file and tape, and know how to transfer to my computer. That's all. There's probably a lot more I could do, but I don't need to do a lot more at the moment. And I looked enough to see what else I could do, and decided at the moment I don't. If I need to, then I look at the manual. So this is a function of tutorial. It's a function to, I mean, let you know that how to do basic things, and give you an overview of what the program can do. And it could be printed or it could be online. And some people prefer to read, and some people prefer to sort of go through and follow along and have it interactive. Either way. A reference manual you need for to look something up. And there, of course, it's just like any, actually I have for each criteria. A quick reference chart, if it's available, is very helpful. Because if I don't have one, I have to make one. It takes a lot of time. And I may have other pieces of documentation which I don't know about. So for each, you would look at it from the point of view of readability. And you all have read this explanation and you say, what? Because it was written maybe by the person who wrote the program and not by somebody who really knows how users think. Ease of finding specific points. That's often a difficulty in help. It's getting better, so you might be able to, but it's often hard to find. How quickly can you find this part of ease? Do they give you a simple explanation first that may suffice for your purpose right now? And then, if that's not satisfactory, you can drill down to more complexity. How complete is it? Is it correct? Or does the documentation tell you to do something that actually does not work? That happens. And be non-redundant. Most reviews will review documentation and limit themselves to documentation supplied by the software vendor or software manufacturer. That's not the interesting question. The interesting question, what documentation is there anywhere? And if I need to buy a book, that's just added to the cost. I don't know how many books there are in Microsoft Word. There are fewer and we're perfect. And there may be still fewer on Excel. Well, Excel may have a lot. But so my calendaring software is not used widely enough to have a book written by a third party. Also, don't ignore the web. There may be lots. I mean, there are lots of good things on the web this is another piece. How easy can you find stuff on the web on this? Sometimes I find it easier to do a Google search than to consult Microsoft Word Help. There are lots of places that give you instructions how to do it. I think when I did 690, there were some more complex things people had to do in Word, and I didn't tell them how to do it, I just gave them a website that explained it clearly. So, this is written documentation available anywhere. And the same is true for online help available anywhere. I mean, clearly you need to look at the online help that comes with the program. But you also need to look at what can be found through Google.
There's some of the things that don't come on a CD that are online services. They don't have a book that you get in the mail, but they may on their website. It's not online help because you don't hit a help key, but you go into a manual. It's written documentation,
yes.
But it's on the web.
So right.
Is that... I call it written documentation, but it is online.
That's fine.
Help, no. It's just not integrated.
Yes. No, written doesn't mean printed. It could be online.
Yeah.
Fine. And it could be anywhere. And in fact, the distinction between written documentation and online help is sort of getting blurred. The production of these, they are small. They reuse the text from the reference manual in the online help.
The online help just points, just pulls it from there.
Except that in online help, you have the designer has the ability to put in a link that invokes the function that you need to do. So it says, call up this, and it gives you a link right there, and you click it, and you are in the configuration screen for WordPerfect, and you can then do it.
It's interactive.
Yeah.
The written documentation can't really be interactive.
Yes. The online help can also be context sensitive. So we're now under F2, and it gives you levels of context sensitivity. So that. Contact means where are you in the program? Are you in tables? So, the very general, if you click on the help button, you just get the help content and sources in a fairly standard Windows piece. So that doesn't do anything. Somewhat more general, if the cursor is in a table and you click on help, Word might give you some explanation of how to do tables. Be more specific. even more specific, if I've highlighted a menu choice but I don't really know how to, what it does or how to work it, if I press the help button, I get an explanation of that menu choice. Then still more specific is really only possible in response to an error. So this would be in a word processing program that wouldn't actually apply because there are no error messages. But in a spreadsheet, there may be an error message. And so if you got and say cell is empty or blind reference or whatever, and you press help, I think Excel still gives you the general help feed if you do. But it would be better if they would give you specific help on that error. Now, when you write a Java program, and have all of you done a little bit of programming in 690? So this becomes a little different in the, when you write programs. Then the context sensitivity to the error messages becomes more interesting, and we actually have the same setup which we look at shortly under error handling. It's also, there's also a question of context sensitivity. Then how can you move around in online help or in a manual that's online, which may still be slightly different, but in online you can have hyperlinks. And so I mean many online help offered by the program will have see also, or they will have explanation of concepts. And you can even click and get a little bubble that gives a definition of a term, stuff like that. All of that is helpful in interacting. It's helpful. Okay. So actually, let's take a break now, and then we will go through the rest of these criteria, and probably in part of the next lecture we'll go to 1.5. And I think we'll probably move to 2.1 and maybe even finish today. We'll see. Okay, so we'll reconvene at 2 o'clock. End of this lecture.